Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Vayishlach, means "and he sent." The Torah portion is Genesis, starting at chapter 32, verse 3, to Genesis 36, 43. The Haftarah is Obadiah 1, verses 1 to 21, and the Brit Hadashah is Hebrews 11, verses 11 to 20, and Matthew 26, verses 36 to 46. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, we just ask you to bless us on your Shabbat as we study your word. Pray that you will protect and provide for all of your family all over the globe, wherever they are scattered, that you will bring us home very soon, and that you will help us to understand from this Torah portion the things that are happening in Israel today and how they were set up here in this Torah portion. I just pray these things in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Okay, well, I have to tell you that, you know, probably some people are going to object to what I'm going to say right now, but I'm a little bit disappointed in Jacob. You know, sometimes people don't want to hear that our forefathers did some things wrong, and that maybe they shouldn't have done some kind of certain things, and maybe they had a good reason for doing things wrong, or doing something they should not have done, but in this particular case with Jacob, you know, while we can say those things about Abraham and Isaac, this particular thing with Jacob really is problematic. Jacob did some things that he should not have done. And those things that he did that he should not have done have set us up now for what's happening in the Middle East. Why is this? Well, as we're going to see, in this Torah portion, Jacob gave back his birthright to Esau and literally made Esau king in the land of Israel. And as you probably know, kings do not so easily give up their territory. So this Torah portion is full of politics, and it reads like the daily news headlines. If you are reading this Torah portion, you are reading what's going on in Israel today. Let's go to Genesis 32, verse 3. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother to the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Well, first of all, he's not even going through Seir. He's coming into the land from a different way. So why does he go send messengers to Esau to say, "Hey brother, I'm home"? Why doesn't he just go into the land and take the land? Well, that's a very good question. And when we get into the kingdom, I'm certainly going to ask him that question. So the point is, it was not necessary even for Jacob to do this. Verse 4, and he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall you speak to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now." So he's sending them to speak to his Adon, lord, and your servant Jacob. So right here, we can start to see that Jacob is giving Esau control of himself, and later on we're going to see how he has given Esau control of the land. Now that word Lord, Adon, can mean master, but it also means controller. So he was acknowledging that Esau is the controller of the land. So in verse 4 it says, he commanded them, saying, Thus you shall speak to my lord Esau. There he goes again. Your servant Jacob says, just I have so I'm sorry, I just read that, didn't I? I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now, and I have oxen and asses, flocks and men servants and women servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight. You see, Jacob is anticipating that there is going to be a problem with Esau. But instead of going boldly into the land the way he should have, he is cowering into the land. And now he's giving Esau an idea of the wealth that he has received while he was with Laban, knowing that Esau's going to try to come for it. So he was getting ready to do something for Esau that is going to change the way that things turned out in the Middle East 4,000 years ago, and it's still affecting us today. Genesis 32:6, and the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and also he comes to meet you and 400 men with him." See, if Jacob had just gone into the land, if he had just gone into the land, let me repeat this, if he had just gone into the land, Esau might not have known that he was there for quite some time. Because it's these messengers, when they went to Esau, alerted Esau, and now he's coming. You see, Esau didn't know Jacob was coming. He's coming now. The messengers went, and they returned to Jacob and saying, "We came to your brother, and now he comes to meet you, and he has 400 men with him." Now, I've done a teaching on this in the past about Esau's 400 men, but just let me give you a little summation of that. That number there is not just any random number of men meant to show that, you know, Jacob is outnumbered, but that number 400 means Messiah. Now, the Muslims have a Messiah. So the Messiah that is with Esau is not Yeshua. So this is a prophecy of some future time when Esau approaches Jacob with a Messiah, you see, with a government system that is set up and based upon their Messiah. That's why we have this particular mention of Esau's 400 men. And especially we're going to see that it was mentioned twice, which tells us that it's something we need to pay attention to. Because back then, Esau did approach Jacob with 400 literal men, but the prophecy has to do with, in the end of days, when they approach Jacob with their men who are under the governance of their Muslim Messiah. You see? Verse 7, Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands and said, "If Esau comes to the one company and smites it, then the other company which is left shall escape." So, you know, when you have made this kind of mistake, sometimes you have to fall back. And that's what Jacob has done here. But truthfully, this is also a prophecy of the Lord's plan to split the house of Israel and to split it into the house of Judah and the house of Israel, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. Nonetheless, getting back to the scripture here, Jacob recognizes Esau as a war threat and has to take some kind of action. So he splits up his household. But where, if the escapees had to go, if one camp was overrun by Esau and the other camp had to escape, where did Jacob think they were going to go? Were they going to go to Egypt? Were they going to go back to Babylon with Laban? And if they had to flee, would they have been able to maintain their identity as children of Jacob? You see, Jacob did not really think this thing through. Verse 9, and Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will deal with you.'" Now, he's in trouble here. So now he's turning back to the Lord after he discovers the depth of his trouble and after having made this horrible mistake by signaling to Esau that he's back in the land. You see, what he should have done was he should have approached the land first, coming to the Lord and dedicating the land with an altar. You see, the Lord is then later on, after this gets further on into the story, the Lord will have Jacob build an altar. And altars are God's ownership seal on the earth. Jacob should have built an altar, should not have said anything to Esau. He should have just built an altar and put the Lord's stamp back in the land. And then it would have been the Lord's job to deal with Esau, you see, but Jacob did what we often do, didn't he? We often get our horses and carts backwards. You do know that horses cannot push carts. They have to pull carts. You get to get that horse in the front. The power has to go before the cart, the thing that carries you, you see. So when we get the cart before the horse, what we're saying is that we think our power can carry the day. Well, Jacob here is about to learn a valuable lesson, and he's going to leave this lesson for us to deal with down here at the end of days. Verse 10. And he continues talking here to the Lord. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have showed to your servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray you, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother of the children. And you said, I will surely do you good and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So you see, now he's reminding the Lord of his promise. You know, critical thinking is a really good skill to have. The ability to look at a situation and think, if I do this, what will happen? If I do something else, what is likely to happen? If I do this other thing, what might I expect? That is part of a discipline that a lot of people don't have, where they can't look into the future and see the many possibilities based upon various actions that they're going to take. Now, Jacob is a brilliant man, and he was able to do this kind of critical thinking thing, you know, with Laban when he got ready to leave. But let me just remind you that he didn't have this critical thinking in place when he got into a covenant with Laban and ended up with Leah and not Rachel. You see, he got blindsided by Laban, and here he is putting himself into a blind position with Esau. He's got skill. He's able to think in regards to his occupation as a shepherd. But when it comes to leading properly, Jacob doesn't seem to have this skill. Now, I know I'm probably going to get a lot of emails about this, but y'all know that I am on Jacob's side. I'm just telling you that Jacob is as human as you and I are, because we still do this stupid stuff, don't we? Okay, so just know that I am with Jacob. I'm just pointing out to you how we got to this mess in the Middle East in the end of days. Verse 13, and he lodged here that same night and took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau his brother. 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. Now, when Jacob was in exile, the Lord made him wealthy. That wealth belongs to the Lord. Let me explain to you why I say the Lord made him wealthy in exile. In Genesis 30, verse 43, while he is still with Laban, it says, and the man, that's Jacob, increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses. You see, it was in the exile that the Lord blessed him and made him prosperous. Now, so that wealth actually belongs to the Lord. You do know that when the Lord blesses you with something, it's really not yours. It really belongs to the one who blessed you with it. Oh, and by the way, if you think that, you know, if you go out into the world and you can make a lot of money, that you're not beholden to somebody, think again. Because out in the world, who blesses you is Satan. So what you have really belongs to Satan. You see, he's got legal claim on it because he blessed you with it. You understand? There's only two ways to get blessings. One is from the Lord and one is from Satan. Now, I realize that money itself is not part of the list of the Lord's blessings. But Jacob was not made wealthy with money, with coin. He was made wealthy with lots of cattle and servants and camels and such, you see. And those are part of the blessings. And so what he has belongs to the Lord. And here he is. He's going to divide it up and give some of it to Esau. Here is the promise that Jacob made to the Lord. We need to understand this promise that he's breaking, that he made to the Lord. We got to go back to Genesis 28:15. And he says, behold, I am with you, and I will keep you in all places where you go, and will bring you again into this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you of. That verse right there was spoken by the Lord when Jacob dreamed about the ladder. Remember, I talked to you about the ladder is actually the Lord himself. Verse 16 says, and Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. Now, suddenly, what we've got here, because the Lord made him a promise, the Lord is actually bringing Jacob officially into the covenant that he made with Abraham. He says, I am going to be with you and keep you in all the places where you go. He's got to do this. The Lord has to do this with Jacob in order to fulfill that covenant with Abraham. So we now know that Jacob is officially in covenant with the Lord. And as a matter of fact, it says in verse 18, and Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon it. And he named that place Beit El, or Bethel, you see. And he vowed a vow, saying, so when he poured the oil upon the top of that pillar, it was a type of an altar. And he vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. Okay, so, do you think the Lord has fulfilled that? Has the Lord provided Jacob with bread to eat? Yes. And has he provided raiment to put on? Yes. And by the way, having enough to eat is one of the promises of the Lord. That's why, you know, he helps us to get cattle and those kinds of things. But clothing, raiment, that is not one of the blessings of the Lord. Yet the Lord took care of that for Jacob, didn't he, in Laban's household. And so Jacob now is coming back into the land with the wealth that the Lord gave him after having taken care of him with food and raiment. He's coming back into the land and he's going to give part of his wealth to Esau. But here's the problem of, here's a further problem that there is with this promise, because he says in verse 22, and all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth to you. Now, you would probably ask yourself, well, as long as he gives a tenth of it to the Lord, What's wrong with him giving part of it to Esau? After all, Esau is his brother. Well, there are several things wrong with Jacob giving this to Esau, but let's get an understanding about what it means when you give a tenth to the Lord. The tenth of your income, which is, we call it tithes. So when you pay a tenth or you pay your tithe to the Lord, two things are happening. One is you are paying tribute to the Lord your God. That's your tribute to your king. That says that I am still in covenant. And if, by the way, if you're not paying tithes and you claim to be in covenant with the Lord, you ought to just kind of, you know, give this a thought. Because you paying your tithe somewhere means that you are showing that you are in covenant with him. And the other thing about the tithe or the tribute to the king is that when you pay that out of your income, you are also signaling that you know that the 90% that's left is perhaps yours to dispose of, but it really belongs to him. You see, that one-tenth represents 100%. 10% is the symbol of 100%. So just keep that in mind. The idea here is, though, that Jacob left the land of Babylon. He left Laban and lived with Laban as a pauper, became wealthy there, and was supposed to return back to the land as a king. He was supposed to come back to the land and take his proper place. But he didn't. He's going to give his kingship over to Esau, and it's going to cause us to be dealing with it. It sets the precedent, and we're dealing with it now at the end of days. And I believe that the fact that Jacob gave his rightful kingship over to Esau is one of the reasons the Lord said that the children of Israel would be exiled in Egypt back there when he was talking with Abraham. You know, he told Abraham, your descendants are going to go down into Egypt for four generations. So, every time that we fail to keep a vow to the Lord, we pay a price, and sometimes our descendants do too. Now, we are going to return to the land as royalty. We're going to return as kings and as priests, you see. But when we return, there is a different king coming. He's not going to be Jacob this time. He's not going to be one who is afraid to go boldly into the land. The one who's going to take the land this time is called Yeshua. And he is going to go in there and take Esau out, you see. And this is one of the things that will prove to the world that Yeshua is the Messiah. And it will also show us that Jacob was only a man, and that no man is able to do what Yeshua can. Now, again, I want to tell you that I love Jacob. But look, you know, I was raised with parents here. You know, I'm 57 years old now, and I had parents when I was born, and I love them, but I don't agree with everything they did, okay? So disagreeing with what our forefathers did and seeing their faults in Scripture is actually God's way of saying, learn from their mistakes. And by the way, I don't have a long enough life to make every mistake that there is possible to make, so I just have to learn from other people's mistakes, and that's why the Lord lets us see the faults of our ancestors. Genesis 32:16, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants. Every drove by themselves, and he said to his servants, pass over before me, and put a space between drove and drove. And he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esau my brother meets you and asks you, saying, whose are you, and where goest you, and whose are these before you, then you shall say, they shall be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, also he is behind us. And so commanded he the second and the third, all that followed the drove, saying, on this manner shall you speak to Esau when you find him. You know, there's something significant about there being three servants here. Jacob sends three servants, one with the goats, one with the sheep, and one with the camels. So going with those three servants are goats, non-believers, sheep, believers, and camels, the wealth of the world, you see. So this is what Esau has now, what the Palestinians have now. There are Muslims, non-believers, Christians, Jews, Hebrew roots people, believers, sheep. And the Palestinians have Israel's wealth. Why do I say they have Israel's wealth? Well, Israel pays into the PA economy, which, you know, the Palestinians just can't manage their money. And recently we found out that $3 billion have come up missing out of the Palestinian coffers. Nobody knows where that went. And also, Israel takes care of Palestinian citizens. You know, Palestinians are citizens of Israel. And so they benefit from Israel's wealth, you see? So you can see how those three gifts to Esau are in the land today. Genesis 32:20, and say you moreover, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Peradventure he will accept of me. There's that word appease, means Jacob is trying to bribe Esau. And of course, Esau is always willing to accept the gifts of appeasement and put off killing Jacob for a later day. And because these gifts are part of Jacob's wealth, all the much better for Esau. You see, the blessing to Esau was that he would partake of Jacob's wealth, not that Jacob would give him his wealth. Verse 21, so went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. So he stayed kind of with his family. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Yabok, or Jabok as it is in the King James Version. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over what he had. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now, this man is Yeshua. And it's very important for us to understand that this man is Yeshua, because this wrestling match has to do with us at the end of days. The question that we have to ask ourselves in order to understand why this man is Yeshua is, why did Yeshua pick a fight with Jacob? Well, it's because Jacob has just done what he did, and we're going to learn a little bit more about that here in a minute. Verse 25, and when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. And he said, I will not let you go except you bless me. So now Jacob is asking for a blessing. Now, he's asked for grace from Esau, but he's asking for a blessing. You don't ask people for a blessing. You ask God for a blessing, you see. So, the struggle here that's going on between this man and between this man and Esau has to do with our struggle before we can become the nation of Israel. And it is because we have made Esau our king in the land. And so the reason that Jacob is wrestling with this man is because he has vowed to pay tribute to Jehovah, and now he is paying tribute to Esau as well, you see. So now this man has a covenant lawsuit. Wait a minute. If it's a covenant lawsuit, it can't be just any man. It can't be just an angel or a messenger sent from the Lord. It has to be the Lord himself. It has to be one who is able to contend with Jacob over the covenant lawsuit. You see? Verse 27, and he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince have you power with God and with men, and have prevailed. So, verse 29 says, Jacob asked him, tell me, I pray thee, your name. And he said, why is it that you ask after my name? And he blessed him there. Now, one of the things we have to understand is that for us to get into the land, because let me explain this. The Lord has a covenant, a lawsuit against the house of Israel and the house of Judah. He's got a covenant lawsuit against you and me, even though we're keeping the Torah. We're forgiven. But he's got a covenant lawsuit with us because you do know that none of us are getting this actually perfectly right, because we don't have all the information and we're just doing the best we can. Yes, the Lord is going to account that to us for righteousness, and we will not suffer from this covenant lawsuit if we are doing the best we can, okay? Nonetheless, there is a covenant lawsuit coming, because the Bible says judgment starts in the house of the Lord, right? And so some of us are going to get hit with more of it, and some of us less of it, depending upon our relationship with the Lord. You know, those that are not keeping the Torah at all, well, you know, they're going to get more of it. Those of us who are doing the best we can, we're going to get less of it. Nonetheless, we have this Torah covenant lawsuit coming. And so for us to get into the land, we're going to have to ask for the blessing. And there's a time coming when we will all say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And now I want to bring out something else here about verse 29, where Jacob asks Yeshua to give him his name, and Yeshua does not give him his name. Instead, he blesses him. You know, Moses was told by the Lord that the forefathers did not know God by his name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And yes, Virginia, Yeshua is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And I don't have time to go into that right now, and I know some people don't believe that, but I do believe it. And so this is why Yeshua did not give Jacob his name yet. It was not time for him to give the name to the children of Israel. You're only going to get the name of the Lord when you're headed back to the land to set up a kingdom. And Jacob wasn't there to set up his kingdom. He should have been there to set up his kingdom, but right away he gave up his kingdom. So he didn't get to know the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, you see? Because now we have to wait for another few hundred years for Moses to come along and the children of Israel to get out of Egypt because of Jacob's actions here, you see? And the Lord knew in advance that this was going to happen, but you don't get the name written on you until you go into the land. Verse 30, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. So Jacob saw God face to face and lived like Moses. And we know this is another way that we know Yeshua is the man that was struggled with there, and that makes Yeshua God, because Yeshua says no one has seen the Father and lived, right? But we have seen Yeshua and lived, you see? And so Yeshua is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and he is God. Genesis 32:31. And as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh to this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. 33:1. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. Here's that second mention of the 400 men. And he divided the children to Leah and to Rachel and to the two handmaids. So this is now a prophetic reference to us meeting Esau in the end of days. And we do know that's going to happen, because we have in this Haftarah with us Obadiah, which is one chapter, and the whole chapter is about us meeting up with Esau and destroying Esau. Verse 2, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. In the ancient Near East context, bowing 7 times was what you did to become a vassal of a king. Or if you were already a vassal to a king and you met the king, you would bow 7 times. So you see, Jacob gave up his rightful place, his kingship, to Esau. Jacob broke the covenant. This is why the children of Israel had to be exiled, and in fact, Jacob was exiled into Egypt, right? When you break the covenant, you get exiled. How do I know that this was not the way it was supposed to be? Well, we have to go back to Genesis 27, verse 26. And his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." He's talking to Jacob. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, give you of the dew of heaven and fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone that curses you, and blessed be he that blesses you." You see, it was supposed to be the other way around. Esau was supposed to bow to Jacob. But Jacob has now turned that on its head. But we should take heart from this story, because we know the Lord is still going to fulfill his covenant. After all that the believers have done to the Lord over the last 6,000 years, why would the Lord continue to just fulfill his covenant? Why wouldn't he just say, I just can't do this. I'm going to just destroy all of mankind. Why, every time he gets close to that, like with Noah's flood and those times when he was with Moses and wanted to start over with Moses, why didn't he just kill everybody and start over? Well, it's because he made a promise and he's got a plan A, and the Lord does not go back on his word. You see, we go back on our word, but the Lord does not go back on his word. And the reason that he's going to fulfill this covenant is because he doesn't go back. It's to prove who he is. It's for his namesake, not because of us. We don't deserve the rewards and blessings we're going to be getting from our Father. And in fact, if we go back and look at our forefathers that he loves so much, and including Moses and David and Joshua and those guys, we will see that they all did things that were disappointing to the Lord. So there's not one human being on the earth who deserves the rewards and blessings that are forthcoming. But of all our ancestors, Abraham is the one that had the greatest depth and strength of faith. Jacob did not seem to have that same depth and strength of faith of his grandfather. And so, when you're faced with difficult situations, sometimes we do things that we shouldn't do. And this is the case with Jacob, and it's good for us to learn from it. Genesis 31:13 says, I am the God of Beit El, where you anointed the pillar and where you vowed a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your kindred. So Jehovah here is reminding Jacob who he is and the vow that Jacob made to the Lord. 33:4 And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him and they wept. Well, prophetically, we understand that this kiss is really a bite yet to be fulfilled prophetically. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children, and they you know, all introduced each other. And then Esau says, keep what you have. Don't give me your presents. Well, now, Jacob ain't falling for that because he knows his brother is greedy. And he says, no, just go ahead. If I found favor in your sight, meaning if you're willing to let me into the land, then just receive this present at my hand. He says, take, I pray you, my blessing that is brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me. You see, he's acknowledging here that he's gotten this blessing from the Lord. He says, I have enough. And he urged him to take it. Jacob is already on the hook to give these gifts to Esau. And if he had said, oh, sure, I'll just go ahead and keep that, Jacob would have been in a heap of trouble with Esau. Verse 12, and he said, let us take our journey and let us go and I will go before you. That's Esau. Now, so what Esau is wanting Jacob and his family to do is to come and be a part of his family. You see, Esau's thinking is that he might be able to get rid of Jacob's pure line and he would be able to get rid of Jacob's claim on the land for good if he could get Jacob to come with him, to intermarry into his family and to be assimilated into Esau's family, you see. So that's why Esau invited him to come along. And he said to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender, the flocks and the herds are young, and if we overdrive them, you're going to kill them. Well, he says, let my Lord, I pray you, pass over before his servant. I will lead softly and, you know, come to Seir at some other time. You know, any excuse will do to get away from the one that you know wants to kill you. You know, he's trying to talk his way out of being destroyed here. And Esau said, well, let me leave some of my people with you. And Jacob says, oh, there's no need for that. Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord. You see, he keeps now having to cower more and more and more. He keeps having to kowtow more and more and more to Esau. It just gets worse and worse and worse for Jacob. Esau is not giving up having a hold on Jacob, and Jacob is saying, no, just trust me. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkot and built a house and named the place Sukkot. Now this place Sukkot, that's the first place that the children of Israel came to when they left Egypt, right? This is the first place that Jacob went to when he got into Egypt, when he was fully into the land of Egypt. And it's also the place where we're going to go when we go into the land. It's the first place we're going to go after we kill off the Edomites, you see. We're going to go to Sukkot. The killing of Esau is what the book of Obadiah is all about, and that is what will presage our going to Sukkot when we come back from our exile. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Then after we go to Sukkot, then we're going to go to Jerusalem, you see? Now, I know the children of Israel, when they came out of Egypt, didn't go directly to Jerusalem because they messed up and didn't get to go. But the route that we're supposed to go is, you know, over to the land, kill Esau, go to Sukkot, go to Jerusalem. That's the route in the end of days, in the new millennial kingdom, you see, when we get to go back to the land. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected an altar and called it El Elohei Israel. That means God, the God of Israel. All right, so now we have in chapter 34 another way of expressing end time events. Today we have Ishmael, Esau, the Persians, and all the other ites being intermarried, living in the land, and all over, actually, in the Middle East. So their thought is that if they can rape Israel, you know, as they raped Dinah, or Dinah, however you want to pronounce her name, if they can marry Israel, they can destroy Israel's pure line and Israel's claim on the land, you see? And so that's what this story of Dinah is about. It is about raping the daughter of the Lord. Dinah, in this case, is the daughter of Jacob, but she represents the daughter of the father. And in this story, the concept of circumcision comes up again. It shows us how we use circumcision as a way to conquer people. You know, we're down here at the end of days. The Ites, the Ishmaelites, the Edomites, all those Ites, are trying to rape and then be able to marry the daughter of the father, Dinah, Israel. And the way that the Jews are trying to get back at this, how they're trying to circumvent this, is by getting people to convert to Judaism, which is to make them become circumcised. And in this story with Dinah, we have this again, that the idea is that if they become circumcised, then you can conquer and kill them, you see? I'm telling you, Judah, it doesn't work that way. Circumcision is not for that purpose. But right now, it's probably the best idea that you know, that the children of Jehovah can come up with, and I'm not saying that lightly either, but you get the drift of what I'm trying to say about they're trying to marry us, trying to rape and marry us because they want to take away our legitimate and pure claim to the land of Israel. And the counter to that is that Judah wants everybody to convert to Judaism and be circumcised, because if they do that, then they have conquered that enemy. You see what I'm saying? Let's go on to verse 35. And God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Beit El and dwell there, and make an altar to God that appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother." So now the Lord has asked Jacob to go back to the place where he saw the vision of the ladder, or the dream of the ladder, and to put the altar there, which is a sign of ownership. All of the altars built by our forefathers were signs of ownership of the earth. Why did the Lord have to have our forefathers make these altars? Was it because he was saying, well, it's okay, you can just go sacrifice anywhere you want to? No, because we know that later on, he's going to say you can only sacrifice in one place. The reason that he had our forefathers, from the time of Noah forward, to put up altars at various places in the land is because he had to stake his claim to the land. Remember, by that time, the Lord was already in a fight with the enemy who wants to remove the Lord from the land and wants to claim the land and this entire earth for himself. And so the Lord needs to stake his claim to the land so that the children of Israel will have a place to inherit after the Exodus. Plus, later on, we're going to find out that the Lord has written his name in the land as well. And, of course, in the end of days, that plays out a prophetic significance that I don't have time to go into here. But the significance of the altars have to do with the Lord's ownership. Genesis 35:2. Then Jacob said to his household and to all that were with him, "Put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments, and let's go up to Bethel and make an altar to the Lord, who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way I went." And they gave to Jacob all the strange gods and their earrings and all that stuff, and Jacob hid them under an oak. Now, really, I wonder if he really thought that the Lord didn't know that he hid those anyway. Never mind. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. Whoa! Let's go back and look at verse 5 again. The terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them. You see what happens when the Lord goes before you and you don't try to do it on your own. See, if Jacob had gone to the land, had set up God's ownership symbol of the land, and had taken the Lord with him and had let the Lord go before him into the land, there would have been none of that episode with Esau. And so he goes to build the altar, and in verse 10, the Lord said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." And he called his name Israel. Now, why is this significant? We're always trying to figure out what does the name Israel mean, and everybody's got a different idea about that, but it's not so much what the name means as much as what it has to do with us going into the land. You see, when you're outside the land, you're known by a separate name. But when you go to the land, you become Israel. You become the nation. And that's why Jacob gets his name changed, because he's going back to his inheritance. He is now Israel when he is in the land. 35:11, and God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac to you, I will give it. And to your seed after you will I give the land." And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and poured a drink offering, and poured an oil offering on there. And he called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. And now he journeys from Bethel and goes to Ephrath, where Rachel goes into labor, where she's laboring for Benjamin, and she dies there and is buried there in the town called Ephrath, which today is Bethlehem. And Jacob puts a pillar upon her grave, and it is said that Rachel's grave has a pillar to this day in verse 20. And Israel journeyed and spread his tent below the tower of Eder, and talks about his sons there, how he had 12 sons, and it lists their name. And it talks about how Isaac died. Isaac was 104 years old, meaning he was 180 years old. And then we see that Esau and Jacob buried him together. So Jacob's genealogy comes first in this Torah portion, where the genealogies are. And that's because those genealogies are the ones, the names of the children, that will inherit the land. Second, in the next part after Isaac dies, is the genealogy of Esau. who will not inherit the land. But there are some important clues in here about Esau. And if you've listened to the Esau effect, you will understand that there's a basic premise going on here in chapter 36, where we see the sons of Esau listed, and then we see the dukes of Esau listed, and then we see the kings of Esau listed. And so we get the idea from that Esau took over there. He took over the government at Mount Seir, and that's kind of his modus operandi today, is to just move in and to take things over. And one other important historical thing I want to mention here is about how the kings became kings. Because if you go down to verse 32, chapter 36, verse 32, it starts on the list of the kings. The first king is Bela, and then Jobab, and then Husham, and then Hadad, and so forth, and so forth. But none of those men are related to each other. Well, there's really only three ways to get leaders in over you, and that has to do with either by succession, you know, from father to son, or by war, or by elections. Well, these men weren't related to each other, so they had to be either doing war or elections. But we don't see anything written here about war going on, so that leaves elections. Now, we learned in school that it was the Greeks who invented this thing about elections. Well, turns out that it was actually Esau that got this going, this election process that has followed the world down to today, to America, and then has spread out in into the global population since America has been doing it. But believe me, people have been doing this since Esau invented it. And this is important to understand because it's one of the ways that we know, for instance, the Romans were Edomites. That was one of their signature ways of getting a government, was through elections. And we know that the Greeks were said to have invented it, but they didn't. However, they did use elections in their government process. So the Edomites had influence on the Greeks. So now we see that the Greeks and the Romans were influenced by Edom, by Esau. Then we also know that one of the kings of Egypt was an Edomite, because I have given that teaching in the past, and I believe that that king that did not know Joseph was an Edomite, and I've given all that evidence. So there we have three of the seven kingdoms now that we can see clearly had Edomite influence. And I realized this past year that probably every kingdom that came against Jerusalem to capture Jerusalem had an Edomite influence. They may have been Ishmaelites, I kind of doubt that, but since Esau usurped Ishmael, it's always the Edomite influence that comes forward when somebody goes to conquer Jerusalem, when Egypt and the Greeks and the Assyrians and the Romans and so forth, when they captured Jerusalem, I believe those were descendants of Esau. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there for you to think about that. And I hope that this Torah portion has been a blessing.